Good afternoon and welcome to the EcoNews Report, a production of the North Coast Environmental Center in conjunction with KHSU, located on the campus of Humboldt State University. I'm Raina Nanayel, your host for the EcoNews Report. I am the Executive Director of the North Coast Environmental Center, and our guest today is Ruthie Schaefer. She is the Office Manager and Program Coordinator of the North Coast Environmental Center, and also the creator of a program called New Village Hearts, which is now a project of the Alliance for the Development of Empowerment for Families and Children in the Dominican Republic. Thank you for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We're going to talk today a little bit in an informal, somewhat informal fashion, in a conversational style, about some of the work that she does in the Dominican Republic with stateless Haitians, and talk about the connection between ecology, ethics, and colonialism. So you just got back from the northern part of the island of the Dominican Republic in a region near Puerto Plata, which is a tourist destination. Can you tell me a little about your first impressions when you first went there, not on this trip, but originally?
Yeah, I first had the opportunity to go to the island 2 years ago. I went on a humanitarian service trip with a dear friend of mine who lives here locally. And we worked in a rural Haitian community with stateless Haitians. So it was in the Puerto Plata region, and my first impressions were the huge dichotomy between the tourist industry, which is the main thriving industry on the island, and the backdrop of extreme poverty that both exists with the Haitian community, the undocumented Haitian community that primarily works in the sugarcane industry that's mostly defunct now, and then the Dominican communities, which are also pretty impoverished.
What made you decide to start your project in the DR? Because it had to be a pretty major step for you. Something must have impacted you pretty intensely at that point to make you start a whole new project. And again, your project is called New Village Hearts.
My friend and I, who started this together, were compelled mostly by the circumstances we saw in the village where we were working, primarily just seeing naked babies running around with parasite-ridden bellies that were going hungry, but yet smiling and very optimistic, and the youth, families, and children that were just really trying to get ahead in life but had very little opportunity, and seeing extreme malnutrition, extreme environmental degradation, and a huge lack of opportunity generally really inspired me to want to get involved to create opportunities through resource advocacy for local communities to help get a leg up, whether that be through education, environmental advocacy, health, any number of things.
And they're all tied together. And you have recently, and congratulations, become an official project of ADEFC, which is the Alliance for the Development and Empowerment of Families and Children. And you collaborate with this Florida-based foundation, and they raise funds with Alianza Multinacional. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So we've been working for 2 years as a project, New Village Hearts, as we don't have 501c3 status. So we've held a lot of local fundraisers, and probably folks in the community have seen us around. We've hosted movie night. We've worked with Students for Global Health up at HSU, and we've hosted Wine for World Health. And we've also had the Hopeful Haitian Rummage Sale. And basically, we've been doing this work independent of any fiscal support or without the help of a 501c3. And we finally got an organization willing to take us on as a project. And this summer, we had the opportunity to work collaboratively. We took 9 nurses down and provided mobile medical health services to rural Haitian and Dominican communities that don't have access to ongoing medical services. And it was really the opportunity for us to begin our relationship and start strategizing about how we would like to collaborate in the future, both to support education, healthcare, and environmental education and advocacy.
Alianza Multinacional is the first Haitian incorporated NGO in the northern part of the region. Why is that significant?
Primarily because, as many folks know, Haiti struggles hugely economically and politically. And because of the sugarcane industry, a lot of folks have gone to the Dominican Republic seeking work. There's a huge lack of human rights representation and a huge lack of documentation among the Haitian communities that are there. So for individuals in the Haitian community to have advanced to such a place where they can create a movement or an alliance to help advocate for the disenfranchised Haitian communities is huge, particularly in this instance, because there isn't a lot of that happens. There's a lot of foundations that come into the country that are working with the rural poor, but many of them are international or foreign-based versus this opportunity where you have local community members that are, you know, coming together for the first time to advocate for their own citizenry.
And you said that most of these people are actually undocumented, so they're fighting for their rights in much the same way that Cesar Chavez was organizing undocumented migrant workers in the U.S. That's always a challenge because you don't have any country supporting you. You don't have any support. So that's a very grassroots.
There's no support on either side of the fence, the Haitian side or the Dominican side.
So this organization, in part, was helped along a great deal or formed by Dr. Lambe.
Yeah, Dr. Lambe is Haitian. He was born and raised in Haiti and had come across some political issues in Haiti because it's such a challenging environment to be in. And he and his family moved to the Dominican Republic, and he had the opportunity to study medicine. And he also had the opportunity to come to the United States. And he opted, after having gotten his medical license, to stay in the Dominican Republic and work with the rural poor. So since that time, he's established himself well financially as a local doctor, but he's also opened up a clinic with support from a Canadian couple that provides free and low-income services to an approximate 16 to 20 Bateas communities that have no clinical services whatsoever.
And you told me that Bateas, just for those of us unfamiliar with the term, are rural sugarcane plantation communities. So many of these are fallowed sugarcane.
Historically, they were operative sugarcane plantations, mostly with imported Haitian labor that worked on these plantations for very little money. They were paid by the tonnage, usually a few dollars per ton of sugarcane cut. There's been ebbs and boons in the sugarcane industry over the last two centuries. It started as a huge industry in Haiti under French colonial power, but after Haiti got its independence, it primarily shifted to the DR and was supported mostly by the U.S. Right now, that industry is pretty much dried up, but you have decades of families of Haitian ancestry that have been living and working in the Dominican Republic who have had their families there. And so children of Haitian ancestry born in the Dominican Republic are not granted citizenry in the Dominican Republic nor in Haiti. So this creates this situation of statelessness and huge powerlessness.
So because they have gone somewhere to do farming or kind of a migrant farming or a colonialist farming, that's what creates their situation of being stateless.
You could have a Haitian person documented in Haiti that went to the Dominican Republic to work on a sugarcane plantation that then stayed on because it was too costly for them to return home, or they had nothing to return to in Haiti. That stayed year after year, started to have a family, build up their life, and then as a consequence, their family members, their children, have become undocumented, which has become a generational problem.
Going back to some of the work that you do in these Bateas, it's kind of impressive. 500 to 2,500 people, depending on the Bate, can live in each Bate. So when you're talking about 16 to 20 Bateas receiving healthcare from a clinic, you're talking potentially about a great many people.
Well, Dr. Lambe says he supports an approximate 700 families, and those are, you know, family members. These are folks that are able to afford passage to get to and from his clinic because it's not easy for people to come from rural locations to get to a clinic that's in town, though he does, like I said, he does provide those services to those individuals. But Bateas, like I said, are rurally located. There are no schools, there are no clinics, there's no public transportation in and out. So they're very isolated communities, both economically and geographically.
And they're surrounding Puerto Plata in its decadence as a major center of tourist activity and a lot of gated communities and, you know, what we come to think of when we think of the Caribbean in many cases. So you have these Bateas of intense poverty as kind of islands around the center of tourism where these people don't have access. Let's talk about colonialism, because we just talked about one form of colonialism. We talked about tourism as a form of colonialism where the wealthy multinationals or the Western folks come in and they purchase resorts and they run resorts and the local people don't have access to them. But going back historically, what we have is kind of this region founded early on in a heavily colonialist situation around sugar plantations. So it was first colonized by the Spanish. When are we kind of talking about?
When Columbus first sailed the ocean blue.
Uh-huh. So like 1492 or something?
1492. Hispaniola was the first colonized island of Columbus, and his original fort and all of that is in Santo Domingo, which is the current day capital. and Christopher Columbus introduced sugarcane to the island that then quickly became a sugarcane producing island, both under Spanish colonial rule and then French colonial rule. And then the island, you know, there was wars and turf wars between the French and the Spanish, but has gone back and forth, and both primarily subsisted off of the slave trade industry producing sugarcane sugar.
And the original indigenous tribe was called what?
Taínos.
Taínos.
And they were quickly
annihilated.
Yes. That's the word I wanted to use.
Yeah, so like
rather harsh, but yes.
So like many indigenous people in Central and South America and Mexico, we see this all over the world. We have, you know, this colonization come in, introduction of unfamiliar diseases and things of this nature, poor treatment, and really kind of utilization of these people as a slave class. But in this particular instance, we are not talking about very much time, because 1492 and by 1526, the Atlantic slave trade had moved in. So the annihilation of these tribal people happened very quickly.
Very, very quickly.
I'm speaking with Ruthie Schaefer. She is the program creator of New Village Hearts, a project of the Alliance for the Development and Empowerment of Families and Children.
The treatment of slaves on the island of Hispaniola was considered to be some of the most extreme. And once the Atlantic slave trade, the import of slaves of African descent began, the turnover, even of those folks coming in, was pretty rapid. The treatment was pretty ruthless.
I have it here that 12,500,000 slaves were brought from the west coast of Africa, and only an estimated 10,700,000 survived the voyage itself, and then, you know, thereafter with the disease.
Right, and that was to the Caribbean and both the east coast of the U.S. But yeah, the treatment was pretty severe.
And even still, sugarcane was not on the island originally. And we had this amazing die-off of all the indigenous people. You essentially bring in a new population of slaves to continue the work on the cane plantation. What are we seeing as a result of this? You know, we can talk a little bit about the ecological effects of that monoculture, but essentially it stripped all the cultural integrity from the Taínos. And then, of course, through the whole scale, just taking of other cultures and other tribes from Africa, their cultural resources were taken from them. So let's talk a little bit about the ecological effects that bringing in that colonialist monoculture had on people. Obviously, the Taínos were annihilated and their culture was stripped from them. And then later, the African slave trade, those cultures and those tribes' rights and cultures were stripped from them. What are we seeing today still in terms of continued ecological effects of that monoculture system that has completely removed the Haitian and Dominican Republic's ability to kind of have a real connection to their resources?
I think in Haiti, the impact has been more dramatic than we think of in the Dominican Republic. A lot of times people will talk about seeing aerial images of Haiti compared to the Dominican Republic, and the deforestation is prevalent. It's a huge, huge problem, both from monocropping of sugarcane, but also for fuel use from cutting trees and creating, either for using the wood for fuel or creating carbon, as they say, to make fuel for cooking. So that's been a huge, huge issue. It's also an issue on the Dominican Republic side, though not to the same extent as far as deforestation, though there are a lot of sugarcane fields, miles and miles and miles of them, that are now fallow, that were at one time forested, that, you know, have chemical laden soil and land that is not productive for either local food production or otherwise for reforestation.
And in addition to that, just the whole scale loss of, you know, native species and traditional foods. So I can imagine that since this happened so long ago, there are only isolated pockets of places where people can access traditional foods. And for cultures, forest cultures, that's a part of the power that those cultures have, is that their traditional foods are there. They don't have to rely upon a more capitalist system to generate at least their subsistence needs. And so going back a period, they had access to traditional plants, traditional foods, traditional cultural practices that enabled them to at least subsist. Then you have this monoculture, sugar cane, coming in. All the people, having been introduced to this area, developed a dependence on that system, and that system is causing erosion, poor water quality, and poverty. And I know that you want to talk to us a lot about the relationship between poverty and the environmental influences, because in the contemporary situation, that's really what you're seeing down there. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Like I said, the folks are living in these Bateas communities, so rural, former sugarcane plantations. The way that they were set up initially was a barrack-style living conditions where they're cinder block homes, you know, a small 20 by 20 room with very little, maybe light, one light, if they're lucky, no running water. So people have tried to subsist in these environments where there's no local schools, no opportunity for medical health. They're rurally located, so there's no public transportation to get in and out. There's, you know, lack of proper sanitation, lack of access to clean water, lack of access to waste management. So you have a situation where, because of a lack of resources and infrastructure, these rural communities that have been based on, you know, working the sugarcane plantation have had no opportunity for advancement. And it's really been more detrimental both to public health and to the environment.
And I know you've seen some pretty difficult things. We talked a little bit about how bad it can get. So it's already bad. But then let's say a woman with three children's husband dies or leaves because he has to go somewhere for work and she's got health issues on top of that. You've seen some people who have needs that really go beyond what people can imagine.
The needs are intensive, you know. I mean, a family on a better circumstance might be living in a cinder block home. You can have 10 people living in that home where they're cooking on a coal-fired stove, or they have, you know, a lack of beds, furniture, a lack of clean water. You know, you have the lack of access to birth control. You might have a parent that's died prematurely and a mom that's left with a handful of kids who then develops complications herself health-wise with their chronic things such as diabetes, hypertension. Children are suffering from parasites and other diseases commonly. The infant mortality rate is really, really high. Just this trip I was down, there's a young woman I've known since she was 14, she's 16, and the time I was gone, she got married, got pregnant, had her baby, and the baby passed at 2 months of age when I was there. And a lot of that just has to do with both her getting married young is because she's a young woman that comes from a family where there's 10 children and the parents are unable to sustain that level of that number of children, both food, shelter, education. So oftentimes young women are either having to get involved with prostitution or getting married very young to find opportunity. And then the cycle starts over with having children. But then, like I said, the poverty is so extreme and the circumstances are so intense that, you know, it's not uncommon for women to lose babies. For just the average person, I've known a lot of children that have been orphaned. Both their parents have died. I've seen children of the age of 13 mothering their siblings, having to drop out of school, having no way to provide a meal to their siblings, let alone continue their own personal education.
So we've got this, you know, intense human suffering, which then compounds their ability to really think about organizing when you're living in a survival or a subsistence level based on survival from day to day. It's hard to organize your community or your bate. It's hard to organize around thinking about deforestation and how burning biomass and deforesting your resources that are supporting you for basic needs. We've also talked about water quality in rivers. People bathe in the same rivers where they dump their trash. Cattle enter the streams.
People are having to use the restroom on the stream bank because there are no bathrooms. There's no access. So the river, in my experience, the rivers are the dumping ground and the catch-all for all uses, whether it's water for cattle. The cattle aren't confined in any way. Most folks that have cattle have them on a tether and are taking them around.
I'm speaking with Ruthie Schaefer. She is the program creator of New Village Hearts, a project of the Alliance for the Development and Empowerment of Families and Children. So we have this issue with the water, and I know we've talked that we see the same thing in Central South America, Mexico, where the rivers are the dumping grounds, and there's no organized waste management system. So these basic kind of infrastructures are one way, but I know that we also talked about the importance of local control And that's one of the exciting things about the organizations that you work with, is that, you know, Haitians are a proud people. Dominican Republic, the folks from the Dominican Republic also, they were the world's first black republic in 1804, is that right? So that's really important. And we've seen that too with Native American cultures. And we talked about seeing a lot of this kind of treatment of rivers through the means of poverty. The rivers become this kind of dumping ground, the place where it will get washed away because of a lack of organization around waste management, or a lack of pride because of someone having colonized your culture. And then healthcare effects. And we see this same pattern in a lot of subjugated cultures and communities. So I know we talked about solutions for this, and a lot of times we think, well, we just need to get some rich Westerners down there or some international organizations in there and have them take care of it. One of the problems with that, even though that's great, is that it's not sustainable always. A lot of times they come in, but the people aren't invested and they don't do enough to give the people a solid basis for economic support and sustaining themselves. And we talked about some solutions for this. Of course, one is providing some healthcare, but also education. So getting the local people educated so they themselves can become the nurses and doctors rather than importing the nurses and doctors. But in the interim, you know, having people come down to work with them. So you told me that education was key.
Education, and as far as my experience goes, and also with Dr. Lombe, who we've been working with, and the other ADEFSI in Florida, education is the key because of a lack of documentation and access, the level of education is very, very low. And so for folks to rise up out of that cycle of poverty and economic violence, it's really important to have access to education, both for opportunity, but also for greater awareness of just the connection between poverty and the environment and how that plays out in health. Health is a huge, huge problem. Poor health, premature death. So having a greater awareness of just how those things are connected and how to advocate for one's environment is hugely important. And so I think for organizations, you know, the work that we do, I think is more of an advocacy role, trying to provide resources and access and education, bringing things down, but also giving them the opportunity. I think community leaders are hugely important. And so while we can go down and provide services, it really needs to come from the local level because they're the ones there living in it day in and day out. So it's providing a voice and an opportunity for resources for the local communities.
You talked a little bit about, too, this kind of tragic situation where there is all this fallow sugarcane land and very slowly going back to some state of successional forest. But because it is so impacted by just population, human population, and by the needs of the people, what would be really great is if the rural folks could actually farm, do some subsistence farming and organize some subsistence farms. And that in addition to that, they have some problems with regard to transportation. And again, you see this in so many underdeveloped countries where it's not so they grow the food. How do they get it to market? But what's really tragic, and again, you see this often, is that they don't have access to the land that's just sitting there fallow to farm, to do some subsistence farming or even permaculture, or to organize kind of communities around something that could stay, because that land might get bulldozed the next day by the state.
Right. The sugarcane land is government owned primarily. So even though it's not being actively farmed, there are a lot of squatters, a lot of locals that go and grow food for subsistence farming and to sell. But that's, you know, it's not enduring. It's not something that they can depend on. So it's a huge challenge. So there's need for, you know, infrastructure and advocacy around farming, because that is a known skill and something that it's not something that needs to be taught. It's something that these folks and communities have. It's just having the access and the right to land, and then the ability to organize around other issues that they're very keenly aware of, which are, you know, poor sanitation and water and waste management. You know, folks are keenly aware. It's having access to resources to problem solve, to effectively problem solve.
And you mentioned that the young people, like everywhere, globally, I think this is an issue. Young people aren't wanting to farm or work on farms because they have seen their parents and grandparents, and particularly in a heavily colonized area, work essentially as slaves. So they're desperately craving an education and a kind of more professional route, which is, on the one hand, completely understandable, but it's also tragic to the notion of farming and food creation in your own country and in your own village. And that's an issue that we're seeing everywhere because we devalue the farmer and we devalue the person who works with the land. And that is keenly related to colonization and colonialism and post-colonialist issues across the globe. And I think that we could have an entire show on just that issue. But there are a lot of other issues related to that. And as you say, even just, you know, kind of the situation we see in Mexico with the middleman taking the majority of, or in Central America, taking the majority of the money value on the crops just to get them from place to place. And of course, Haiti and the Dominican Republic are in that same situation, where if they want to get their crops to a market, they don't have the vehicles or the infrastructure in place to do that. So that's another issue.
And the contemporary other professions and opportunity are also hugely important to the young people.
And we talked about some of those, nursing, you know, healthcare, which is huge. And we have a lot of artisans down there, musicians, people who work with textiles. And so from a more grassroots perspective, maybe just providing some of the tools that they need to create some very kind of grassroots artisan economics, and also just education and getting that in place. Just kind of to close out, I wanted to thank you for being with us and talking to us about this. And also thank you for going down and doing this work of your own, you know, funding in many ways, and definitely on your own time. So I wanted to say thank you for being with us, and thank you for doing this important work.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here and share and talk about what we've been doing.
You are also with the North Coast Environmental Center as the office manager and program coordinator. And I wanted to kind of close up the show by reminding folks that Coastal Cleanup is coming up on September 17th, and you are actually the point of contact for that. So you can contact Ruthie Schaefer with the North Coast Environmental Center at 822-6918 if you would like to get involved in Coastal Cleanup. It's Saturday, September 17th from 9 to noon. You can also contact her at ruthie@yournec.org. We also have the night before our wonderful All Species Ball, and we are proud to present our local lineup of musicians, the Sky Miller Quartet, a wonderful jazz ensemble, the Singing Nettles, our fabulous all-girl folk band, and the Miracle Show, our Grateful Dead tribute band. They will be playing for us, in addition to some other folks, surprise guests. So that's the All Species Ball. That is September 16th, Friday, from 6:30 to 11:30 or thereabouts. And it is definitely a costume event, so start picking out your costumes. If you would like to volunteer with any of these events or get involved, you can contact the North Coast Environmental Center. So you can contact us at 822-6918. This has been the EcoNews Report, and my name is Raina Nanayel, and I've been your host for the past half hour. I was speaking with Ruthie Schaefer. She is the creator of a program called New Village Hearts, which is a project of the Alliance for the Development and Empowerment of Families and Children in the Dominican Republic. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. You can hear this broadcast again at KHSU website under archive programs at khsu.org. The EcoNews Report is produced by KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Much thanks to our engineer, Fred McLaughlin. Please join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the EcoNews Report.